Now in its 10th season, Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom is a podcast about tragedy, triumph, unequal justice, and actual innocence. Based on the files of the lawyers who represent them, together with other criminal justice activists and experts, Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom features interviews with men and women who have spent years in prison for crimes they did not commit, some of them having even been sentenced to death. These are their stories. Look for Wrongful Conviction podcasts wherever you listen to podcasts.
Ready to go out to a restaurant? Thermal temperature scanners could be our way back in, but can you really count on these devices for your safety?
I think there's an element here of what's been called security theater, making a big show of doing something, anything, to convince people that they're safe.
Also, we speak with a human guinea pig in a vaccine trial.
I'm not sure whether I got the test vaccine or the placebo. Yep, it was an injection. It hurt, was a little bit numb.
And China has long talked about a peaceful reunification with Taiwan. Now Chinese leaders are leaving out the word peaceful. It's not an accidental omission.
They're pretty meticulous about these things. This was a point they wanted to get across to the international community.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thanks for being here. Living through this pandemic has brought out in us two things. One, patience. There's an acceptance now that the coronavirus will be with us for a while. We've also become impatient, waking up every day hoping for news of a vaccine breakthrough to get us back to normal life. A vaccine would typically take years, if not decades, to develop, but most experts think a vaccine could be available by next summer. That would be a huge scientific feat. There's a lot of attention being paid to and a lot of money invested in one particular vaccine going through clinical trials in Oxford, England. Tiffany Cassidy is a reporter based in Oxford. She's taking part in the trial and got the test vaccine about a month ago. So, Tiffany, why is so much attention going to this particular vaccine trial?
So, firstly, it's the speed of when this could be ready. The Jenner Institute in Oxford was already working on a really similar vaccine, which let them speed up their process. Meaning if their vaccine works, the first doses could, emphasis on the could, be available by September. Another reason to watch it is the U.S. government just announced up to $1.2 billion for hundreds of millions of doses of it, with the first doses to be delivered in October. So massive financial investments are going into this, and a lot of places are looking for a return.
So will this particular vaccine that they're testing in Oxford, will it work? Is it looking promising so far?
So the results that we have so far are from the animal trials. And these animal trials first made the news because the vaccinated animals were healthy compared to the unvaccinated ones. And that looked really promising. Then other scientists shared their skepticism. One major concern was that there was still coronavirus in the noses of the vaccinated animals. And that's what David Salisbury highlights. He's the former director of immunization for the UK's Department of Health. And he says those results show a lack of complete protection.
If a vaccine recipient was exposed to coronavirus, they might be able to spread it to other people. So I think that everybody will look at these results with caution. Clearly, they are the very earliest results, and we need to see what happens next.
And this vaccine might have better results with two doses, which is something that is being tested on humans. And of course, if everyone needs two doses, then that becomes an issue of manufacturing speed. So a lot to be determined.
So Tiffany, you're in this trial. Assuming you've not been given the placebo, what risks are you taking with this?
As a participant in this trial, I obviously am really hoping that this vaccine is safe, and it would be great if it worked as well. But if I received the trial vaccine, the biggest concern is an increased negative reaction to the virus. And with the sped up process of this Oxford trial, the human trials have actually started while the animal trials are still ongoing. But all vaccine trials have safety concerns. And for me, given how important it is to find a vaccine, I'd much rather take on those risks and feel like I'm doing something to help the progress.
So if this works, there will obviously be limits to manufacturing the vaccine. 7.5 billion doses just can't be made overnight. Who will get the vaccine first? Like, how is that decision about front of the line made and by whom?
Yeah, so this is such an interesting case study for how these vaccines will be distributed, because this one is still months away at best, and already two of the world's wealthiest countries have gained early access to it. So the US, I mentioned earlier, has that deal of more than $1 billion to get this vaccine early. And the UK also gave money and struck the first deal. Here was an announcement by UK Business Secretary Alex Sharma.
The UK will be first to get access. And we can also ensure that in addition to supporting people here in the UK, we're able to make the vaccine available to developing countries at the lowest possible cost.
So this comes down to both who decides how to distribute it and what resources there are to influence that decision.
Tiffany Cassidy, a reporter based in Oxford, England. She's taking part in the vaccine trial and reporting on it. Tiffany, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Even though there is still a ways to go to getting something to the public, worrying signs have already emerged around the world about whether people would even take a vaccine. The World's Alana Gordon covers global health for the show. A new Pew survey found that a quarter of respondents here in the U.S. would not take a COVID-19 vaccine, Alana, even if it were available. So in what way is this vaccine pushback playing out around the globe?
Well, Marco, it seems to be becoming more visible in some places. For weeks, some groups of protesters have been demonstrating across Europe. It's not just about opposing a vaccine, but many are there for that.
I'm protesting because they're violating our human rights by locking me down, by forcing a vaccine.
So what you're hearing are protesters in Hyde Park in London earlier this month.
I mean, these are really striking images, and demonstrations, especially now, can be really attention-grabbing. Do you have a sense of how widespread this pushback is? Like, is the anti-vaccine movement building momentum right now?
The visible opposition has been especially pronounced in parts of Germany, like Berlin. It's unclear how widespread or large it is, Marco, but I think the wider concern, especially from what I'm hearing from researchers of disinformation, is that these movements, like this anti-vaccine one, could really be using this really unstable, vulnerable time in all of our lives when science is under public scrutiny like never before, each and every day, to grow its base, especially online.
Right, growing its base, because the movement against vaccines is not a new one, is it?
No, it's not. I talked with Vish Viswanath about this. He's a professor of communication at Harvard School of Public Health. He says what is different now is that this is the first pandemic of the information age. Social media is so much more present in our lives around the globe. Information is just spreading so fast. That's why we have this like new virus. So that can translate into misinformation overload. Here's Vish.
So what's happening, in my view, a group of people have seen an opening to further their own ideological agenda, whether it is anti-vaccine groups, whether it is right-wing anti-immigrant groups, or whether it is state actors, certain governments, who find it very convenient to use this to spread this information.
Right. So, Alana, in this first pandemic of the information age, what can be done to combat vaccine resistance and specifically disinformation about vaccines?
So, Marco, there's research that's actually found that enthusiasm for vaccines goes up during a pandemic, especially when a new vaccine hits the scene. Lots of people are waiting with bated breath for a vaccine because of how powerful that could be. But if you do something like mandate it, for example, in order to like get on an airplane and fly, that can fuel vaccine skeptics' fears right now. I asked Pauline Patterson about this potential growing resistance to a COVID vaccine. She's co-director of the Vaccine Confidence Project at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine.
But I think it's important to be transparent because there's a lot of hopes on this vaccine.
What she's saying is that in any vaccine distribution effort, getting people's trust is super important. And that requires a kind of transparency and open communication about the development process, what's known and unknown.
Right. But what about all the related disinformation that could just fuel mistrust?
Yeah. And again, Harvard's Vish Viswanath, he encourages people really to think first before sharing something that they see on social media. But Vish says it's also unfair to put it all on people to have to suss this all out for oneself.
Something at this scale can be tackled only technologically and institutionally. That's why social media platforms have a very important role to play.
What he means is that governments, again, these social media platforms, they need to be more aggressive about taking on misinformation and disinformation and not just react when some conspiracy finally gains traction.
The World's Ilana Gordon, thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco.
President Trump's top economic advisor said today that Hong Kong may now need to be treated like China. Larry Kudlow said Hong Kong will not get any special treatment when it comes to trade. That's because of China's move to enact a new law that would undermine the city's autonomy. Washington does give special treatment to Taiwan, even though the Chinese Communist Party sees the island as a renegade province and an integral part of China. But now Beijing is updating its plans for Taiwan. As The World's Patrick Wynn explains, it comes down to one word.
Chinese communist officials, when they talk about Taiwan, they have a go-to phrase, peaceful reunification. But at a big party meeting last week, there was a slight detour. The Chinese premier, Li Keqiang, mentioned reunification, but he dropped the word peaceful. And it wasn't a flub. China's officials aren't like Americans. They don't just riff on the mic.
They're pretty meticulous about these things. And this was a point they wanted to get across to the international community.
That's Professor Nicholas Koo at the University of Otago in New Zealand. He studies the Communist Party closely. And he says this missing word was a way to alert two audiences.
The first one is obviously Taiwan. And the second one is the United States.
A few months back, Taiwan had an election. They have those there. And they elected a woman, Tsai Ing-wen, whose party is pretty adamant that they never, ever, ever want to become part of the People's Republic.
If they were able to paint a picture of a more perfect world, it would include one where Taiwan is independent from mainland China. I don't think there's much doubt about that.
The 24 million people living in Taiwan do basically live in an independent state. But they're well aware the huge Chinese military is glaring right next door, saying, one day you'll be ours. One reason Taiwan hasn't been swallowed up by China is the U.S. sells it high-tech weapons, which China hates. Here's Chinese media last year after a huge missile sale.
The ministry is also calling on the U.S. to cut military ties with Taiwan in all forms. It says the Chinese army has the confidence and ability to destroy any action aimed at Taiwan's secession from China.
These days, China probably has enough military power to back up that bravado, if it wants to. All the while, Koo says, U.S. leaders, Democrats and Republicans, seem more keen to get tough with China.
There's a broad consensus in the United States to push back against the expansion of Chinese power in East Asia.
Just listen to Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who said earlier this year, the war on terror is still going.
But times move on, and while we still have to be enormously vigilant about terror, there's still challenges all across the world. The Chinese Communist Party presents the central threat of our times.
Professor Koo says, given all this, China's Taiwan statement makes more sense.
It's no surprise that you get a response in terms of the Chinese omitting the word peaceful.
And there's one other thing going on right now. Hong Kong. Hong Kong is just semi-autonomous from China, but getting less independent all the time. Beijing just passed a law to weed out separatists there. They have a loose definition of that word, separatist, but it seems clear it's aimed at rallies like this. That was posted on Twitter by a Hong Kong journalist. It's people shouting for independence. A fringe view, but it's out there. Chinese state media this week said, when we do take over Taiwan, we're going to face, quote, similar issues to Hong Kong, separatism and anti-China proxies controlled by foreign forces. Again, here's Professor Koo.
It's been a public relations disaster for the People's Republic of China in Hong Kong. It certainly sends a far from positive signal for Taiwan. And that's just the bottom line.
Taiwan's president is also connecting Hong Kong's protest to her island's struggle. She just announced that her government is happy to welcome any Hong Kongers fleeing to Taiwan as their uprising carries on. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
Later, how China is testing 11 million people for COVID-19 in record time. You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. One of the many sectors of the economy hurting during the pandemic is the auto industry. 2020 has seen the worst slump in history for car sales. They're down almost a quarter. Electric vehicles, though, they're doing better than gas and diesel-powered cars. We look at why this week on the World's Climate Solutions segment, The Big Fix.
We have come here to let you know that change is coming, whether you like it or not.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
The only option that we have is to succeed.
What we do now and in the next few years will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
The world's Anna Kussmer is here to talk about the state of the electric vehicle market. So, Anna, why are electric cars doing better than the rest of the market?
Government policies have been supporting the electric vehicle market for a couple years now, and that's given them sort of a boost that they're still enjoying now. Even before the pandemic, the market for electric cars was exponentially growing. Electric vehicles are definitely doing better now, especially in the biggest market, China. It's all about electric cars. As you'll hear in this commercial for the Tesla 3, the most sold electric car in the world last year. So in China, strict fuel efficiency standards pushed the car industry to ramp up production and sales. And a similar thing happened in Europe as well, which is the number two market. There have been ambitious emissions targets that have put a lot of pressure on car makers to get electric vehicle cars into the market. And these targets came with government support through tax incentives, subsidies, and things like that. Another interesting tidbit is because 2020 fuel standards were so ambitious in Europe, car companies actually were delaying filling last year's orders so they could meet this year's targets. And that's part of the reason that 2020 is doing relatively better for electric vehicles.
So if the electric car market is still benefiting from pre-pandemic policies, how is the pandemic itself going to impact sales?
In a weird way, the pandemic may actually help the industry. And again, that's because of government policies. The EU just passed a really big recovery bill that could invest billions of dollars in boosting electric vehicle sales and building 1 million charging stations. China is doing something similar. They spent a couple billion dollars towards charging stations, and they're also extending subsidies another 2 years that were supposed to end this year. Colin McCarricker is a transportation analyst at Bloomberg NEF. That's the company's research arm. He says the demand for electric vehicles is there, and the government policies can sort of catapult the industry forward.
My sense is that you are really going to see China and Europe really sort of lean in on this crisis as a way of driving the agenda that they wanted to drive anyway around the uptake of electric and low emissions vehicles.
McCarricker has really high hopes for electric vehicles moving forward. He just authored a report that predicts around a third of all the cars on the road in 2040 will be electric.
So France this week announced how they're leaning in, a multi-billion dollar investment in electric cars as part of a green future policy to address climate change. But how significant, Anna, are electric cars when it comes to reducing carbon emissions? I mean, they still use a lot of energy, right?
Yeah, it's true. Cars use a lot of energy, but it's hard to tackle climate change if transportation systems are not electrified. If you can imagine a world where all our cars and buses are powered by entirely renewable sources like wind and solar, electric cars are a necessary piece of that vision. Currently, transportation is one of the biggest sources of emissions in many countries, and road transport, particularly passenger cars, is the biggest portion of that. Also, electric vehicles can have a much better effect on air quality. So the pandemic may be changing the way that we drive, and next week I'm going to be looking at how the pandemic is changing the way that we move around in general. So I have a question for our listeners. Are you walking more and driving less, driving instead of taking the bus? I want you to send us an email to climate@theworld.org describing how your habits have changed. I'd love to get you on the show.
Walking more, biking more, and driving less, we'll see. Great question. Anna Kussmer, the environment producer for The World on the electric car beat today. Anna, thanks as always.
Nice chatting with you, Marco.
President Trump signed an executive order today targeting social media companies. The move comes after Twitter flagged this week two of the president's tweets as potentially misleading. Here's The World's Lydia Emanuelidou.
Right now, under U.S. federal law, social media companies have certain legal protections to curate and moderate what's on their platforms. And generally, they can't be held liable for content created by their users. President Trump, through his executive order, wants to change that, to roll back the protections that shield social media companies from liability.
The implications of that are huge.
Kate Klonick is a law professor at St. John's University. She researches how social media platforms are governed. She was first to publish a draft of the executive order. She says rolling back these protections could impact social media users all over the world because it could make social media companies less inclined to moderate problematic posts that end up on their sites, like hate speech.
They might decide that they're not going to weigh into misinformation for anyone, or they're going to walk back some of the policies on content moderation that people have been pushing for years.
Klonick says the Trump administration's move is a reaction to Twitter's decision to mark two of President Trump's tweets as misleading. Trump and his allies say Twitter and other companies have a bias against conservatives. It's an argument Trump's been making for a while. Here he is in March of last year.
It seems to be if they're conservative, if they're Republicans, if they're in a certain group, there's discrimination and big discrimination. I see it absolutely on Twitter and Facebook, which I have also.
Experts say Trump's executive order will almost certainly face legal challenges. David Key is one of them. He's the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Expression and monitors threats to free speech worldwide.
At the end of the day, anything that Trump does to try to remove the immunities that companies have from liability for content that they leave up or take down, that will, in all likelihood, fail under the First Amendment.
Key says it's important to see Trump's executive order as a form of intimidation, one that comes right out of the playbook of authoritarian governments across the globe. He named China, Russia, and Egypt as examples.
They make demands on the companies to take down content, often content that is simply critical of government or sharing information about peaceful protests or other kinds of issues that government simply doesn't want to be circulating.
He says that now, because of the president's executive order, the U.S. no longer has the moral standing to criticize the tactics of repressive regimes.
It's no longer in the position of being able to oppose threats to freedom of expression around the world in the same way that it used to.
Key says that sends a very bad message to the rest of the world. For The World, I'm Lydia Emanuelidou.
You spend time with us every weekday and hear voices and stories that connect you to the world. That connection doesn't stop when we're not on the radio. Continue the conversation on social media about the stories that keep you thinking. We'd love it if you shared them, too. Join us on Twitter. The handle is easy to remember. We're at The World. The lockdown is lifted in Wuhan, China, but it's no party.
Most people are just not going out, especially if they have kids and if they don't need to.
And yesterday's space launch got scrapped, but still signals big things to come. Private companies building rockets opens options for NASA.
Going back to the moon, perhaps onto Mars.
Still to come here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, and PRX. Very soon, you may think nothing of walking into a restaurant and having your temperature checked before sitting down to eat, or being stopped before boarding a flight just to make sure you're not running a fever. A hassle, but necessary. Thermal imaging scanners, or fever detection cameras, as some companies call them, could be part of the road back to normality. But do they actually work? From London, The World's Orla Barry has more.
Every morning when I walk into the main BBC building in London right now, I'm faced with a choice. Do I get my temperature checked or not? There are two lanes in the lobby. One leads you through a thermal imaging scanner. It's basically a computer screen that you stop in front of, and there's a camera a little distance away that picks up your temperature. The other lane just puts you straight through the revolving doors and into the building. Today, I chose to have my temperature checked. There's a security guard standing by.
How are you?
Good afternoon.
So I've stopped in front of a screen and it says
36.9, which...
Which is all right.
Is that all right?
As long as your temperature is not over 37.8 degrees, you're cool. You're cool to be in the building.
37.8 degrees is 100.04 Fahrenheit. I asked the security guard what he would do if the computer screen registered my temperature as higher.
I'd have to tell you to sit out for 5 minutes. You check it again after 5 minutes, and if it's still over this temperature, you'd have to go home, unfortunately.
I'd have to go home.
Yes, yes.
Being told to go back home might not be such bad news for me. But for some workers, it could mean losing a day's pay or worse. Lewis Maltby is president of the National Work Rights Institute in the US. He says he's nothing against temperature checks for workers per se. The problem in some countries is the long wait for a COVID-19 test.
Unfortunately, we don't have any testing capacity to speak of. Now what happens is when an employee shows up with a fever, the employer assumes that they're COVID-19 positive and sends them home, possibly without pay, and who knows when they'll get back to work.
And there's another issue. Your temperature doesn't just go up when you're sick. It spikes after exercise, if you're sunburnt or menopausal and having a hot flash. Ezra Merrill is Vice President of Marketing and Strategy with FLIR Systems, one of the world's largest producers of thermal cameras. He says when used correctly, the scanners don't display a high temperature if you've just had a workout.
It's critical that you use the thermal camera in the right way. You want to look at that point near the eye, near the tear duct, to get a reading. We have not seen an impact from people exercising that would stop them coming through our screening system.
But Jay Stanley is not convinced. He's with the American Civil Liberties Union and has just published a report on temperature checks and COVID-19.
With limited exceptions, the remote standoff thermal scanners tend to be very inaccurate. The scanners are less accurate when a subject is moving, when a subject is far away, when the subject is viewed from the side. These are scanners that can be interfered with by sunglasses, by hats, by hair on the forehead. Add all of this up, and these are very, very finicky machines.
But finicky or not, demand for these thermal cameras has never been so high. Ezra Merrill says they've had requests for scanners from almost every sector in the last 2 months, from airports to football stadiums to hospitals and retail outlets. So have their cameras actually detected anyone with COVID-19?
I can say that, well, we have them deployed in our offices and we picked up a person that had an elevated temperature. They didn't have coronavirus, but they went home and were sick over the weekend.
The ACLU worries that factories and other industries are introducing the scanners mainly for show. Here's Jay Stanley again.
I think there's an element here of what's been called security theater to convince people that they're safe, but it can create false sense of security in people. Oh, I was past the screening at the door, so now I'm not going to worry as much about more effective measures like social distancing.
The BBC says it's introducing the scanners to ease anxiety among staff about coming back to work. Right now, it's up to me to decide if I want my temperature checked at work. But the BBC, like many companies worldwide, is planning to soon make that mandatory. And it's likely to meet some resistance. In the first week of trialling the scanners, Adair says the majority of BBC staff chose not to walk through them. If workers refuse, then what can companies do to start returning to some form of normality? Lewis Maltby, with the National Work Rights Institute, says the answer may not actually lie with the bosses.
Unfortunately, there's not that much employers can do. They don't control the testing capacity. You could ask them to be a little more careful about who they send home. But the real answer is more testing capacity, and employers aren't in control of that.
Jay Stanley from the ACLU agrees. He says everyone already knows the measures that are needed, and they're not that high tech.
It's testing, it's social distancing, it's contact tracing. And that is where the resources need to be devoted. And if temperature checks divert resources from those other more effective techniques for stemming the spread of this disease, then they are not just useless, but they're actively bad.
For The World, I'm Orla Barry in London.
The coronavirus first took hold in the Chinese city of Wuhan. The area went under an unprecedented lockdown, followed by intensive contact tracing and quarantining. Things in Wuhan are slowly returning to something resembling normal. Still, clusters of new cases are popping up. So the Chinese government decided recently to test all 11 million residents. The World's Rebecca Kanther is in Shanghai, so we'll get to this mind-boggling exercise in testing 11 million people in just a moment. But first, Rebecca, what is the latest from Wuhan? Just how close to normal is life there now?
Well, I talked to several people there by phone today, and it sounds like, you know, people can travel freely. They can leave their house. They have a green health code on their phone. That means they can get into most places and be traveling around. There's temperature checks outside of office buildings. Restaurants, small shops are open. But what I'm hearing is that most people are still choosing to stay indoors if they can, especially if they have kids. So that's Wang Donghua. He works in a medical supply company. And he was telling me that most people are just not going out, especially if they have kids and if they don't need to. There's, you know, only about 30% of the regular numbers on public transportation or on the streets. He told me his company is continuing to do work remotely because even though the office could open, only 10 people could be in the office at one time. And so they just chose to have everyone continue to work remotely.
So back in February, Rebecca, when the lockdown in Wuhan was well underway, we saw the videos and got eerie harbingers of our future, completely deserted streets and highways. Today, how is Wuhan's economy doing?
It's suffering. All the people that I was talking to mentioned that, you know, things are really struggling to get back to normal. Because one, people aren't going out, so that means that people are spending less money. Lots of different kinds of businesses have been affected. I talked to an art teacher who says she hasn't been able to pay the rent on her classroom space for months, and she doesn't know what she's going to do. Because schools are not back in session, so that means any small classes like, you know, an art class or a music class, they can't go back to school either. And she said that even though the lockdown has ended, in the past month or so since it ended, she's only left the house 4 or 5 times. And whenever she does leave the house, she says she just feels uncomfortable. She says the disinfectant that's being used in the public spaces gives her headaches, so she doesn't want to go out. So what she was telling me was that yesterday she did go outside for some shopping, and what she found on a busy shopping street were lots of signs saying for rent and for sale. Lots of businesses were closed down.
Sad, although it does sound familiar. And the government testing scheme for Wuhan, 11 million people, that's kind of extraordinary. How's that going?
Well, for the most part, the testing is completed. They've sampled 9 million people and tested 6.5 million. So that's quite an achievement. I read somewhere that they managed to do 1 million tests in a day. So this is the sound of a testing site. All of the nucleic acid testing is free to the public. They're trying to encourage more people to go and get the tests. All the tests are being done outside. So there's lines of people outside in their local apartment communities. Everyone's wearing masks. And the testing is being done by medical workers that are in full protective gear. It's very quick. You line up with space between people. You give them your ID card, and then they swab your mouth or nose. They're really trying to get more people to be tested. So I was looking on TikTok, and there were all these videos to sort of convince more people to go and get tested. So here's one of these TikTok videos where someone is showing the process. So at the end of her video, she says, "Didn't hurt at all. I feel fine." So, but her face looked like she was not so happy.
So what has the testing actually shown so far? And can we trust the Chinese government's numbers and data?
I mean, there's some people who are saying that with that volume of testing in such a short time, that can't be accurate. But I think the numbers came back that 200 people were found positive. People I talked to said it was mostly for peace of mind, you know, really just to show people that, okay, you know, it's safe here now, and you can go out, and you can go back to shopping and going out in the street.
The World's Rebecca Kanther in Shanghai. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
The case of two Canadians being held in China on espionage charges is back in the news. The two men were detained in December of 2018, just days after Canada arrested Meng Wanzhou on behalf of the United States for fraud charges. Meng is the chief technology officer for the Chinese telecom giant Huawei. Beijing has been trying to get Meng Wanzhou released to avoid extradition to the U.S. Yesterday, a Canadian federal court in Vancouver said Meng can be extradited. That may be a win for Washington, but it is potentially very bad news for the two Canadians in China, Michael Spavor, a consultant who arranged business travel to North Korea, and Michael Kovrig, a former diplomat who worked for the International Crisis Group. Robert Malley is the president of the International Crisis Group, Michael Kovrig's employer. He joins us from Washington. Robert Malley, what was your reaction when you heard how the Vancouver court had ruled yesterday?
The connection between the fate of Ms. Meng, who is being held in Canada on extradition charges, to the United States, and Michael Kovrig, who is International Crisis Group, an analyst who was traveling to China regularly without any problem or hindrance for years, the connection was made in the minds of the Chinese. They are holding Michael Kovrig and Michael Spavor as, you know, as pawns in this tug of war they're having with Canada and with the United States. Michael Kovrig, who I know, who is our employee, who was doing every time he was traveling to China, which he's been doing for years on our behalf, he would meet with Chinese officials. He would brief them on what he was finding. And the work he was doing was to try to understand China's foreign policy, wanted to give them insight into what we were learning about those conflicts and trying to recommend steps that China could take to try to de-escalate or end those conflicts. So there was nothing secret. There was nothing that was not fully transparent in the work he did.
So before yesterday and this ruling, what did you understand about Michael Kovrig's case in terms of like how long he was going to be held, what he actually was being charged with, or when he might be released?
Unfortunately, question marks to which we didn't have any answers. And he's now been detained for over 500 days. He's not been told why he's been detained. There's been no formal charges that have been leveled against him. Just think about 500 days where, more than 500 days, where he's not had access to any of his family. He's had one phone call with his father, no family visits. He's had monthly consular visits after a while. Those have been interrupted because of COVID-19, although now the halt on movement or the restrictions on movement have been lifted in China, but not yet on Michael Kovrig's access to consular officers. Everything we're hearing from China is that life is coming back more or less to normal. And there's no reason why those consular visits couldn't resume. And we're hoping that at least on that front, the news will be positive soon.
Yeah, so a really big kind of void of information. What do you know about the conditions under which Michael Kovrig is being held? And what is your best sense of how he's doing?
So we don't know much. And a lot of this is covered in privacy and the confidentiality of the communications between him, the Canadian embassy in Beijing, and his family. So those are not things, you know, I'm not privy to and shouldn't share. I think your listeners can conclude for themselves what it's like to be held in that way without any contact with your loved ones, without knowing when you're going to be released. So I think that should be enough to tell the story.
So what are you most concerned about now, Robert, especially after yesterday's court ruling?
China, as I said, obviously made a connection early on between Ms. Meng's case and Michael Kovrig's case. All we could do is hope that they're not now going to make a further connection between the decision that was made yesterday by the Canadian courts, by the Canadian justice system. Our message to China from day one has been detaining arbitrarily Michael Kovrig, holding him the way they're holding him. That's not the kind of message that China ought to be sending if it really wants to play this part in, as a actor in the international community. And that's the message that we've been sending to China. And so the one today is whatever happened in the Canadian justice system, and by the way, it's not the final word. She's not about to be extradited. This could go on for a very long time. One hopes that Michael's fate will not be held hostage to hers and that there could be a resolution to his case far more quickly.
Robert Malley is the president of the International Crisis Group. Canadian Michael Kovrig was working for the International Crisis Group at the time he was arrested and detained in China in December of 2018. Robert Malley, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
South Sudan became a new nation in 2011. 2 years later, a civil war. That only ended a few months ago. Now, uncertainty, with violence in some parts of the country continuing, cases of COVID-19 on the rise, and many government officials infected. The world's Halima Gikandi has more.
Earlier this year was a moment for hope in South Sudan. In February, the country's rival leaders, President Salva Kiir and former rebel leader Riek Machar, finalized a peace deal in the capital city of Juba. They agreed to share power and promised a new dawn to finally end the country's civil war that began back in 2013 and killed an estimated 400,000 people. That hope didn't last long, though. In the last few months, hundreds of people have been killed in ethnic violence in Zhongle State. And now South Sudan is dealing with the coronavirus outbreak. Riek Machar, who is now a vice president, and numerous other government officials have been infected with COVID-19. And that is making it more difficult to address the cycle of violence. Presidential adviser Tut Gatulak called for an end to the violence last week. He said the government is working to bring peace and stability. But South Sudan watchers point out that the government has also contributed to the violence. Earlier this month, fighting between government soldiers and a local militia displaced thousands of people in the central equatorial region. Archbishop Paul Yukusuk released video messages about the civilian toll.
This war has caused a massive destruction in the entire Pojulu land of Equatoria region. This war has caused us death.
The different forms of violence playing out in South Sudan are complex, but they do have one thing in common. The killing is mostly carried out with small arms like machine guns and rocket-propelled grenades. For years, the country has been flooded with them. Brian Kastner is with Amnesty International. Kastner visited South Sudan back in February to investigate the circulation of weapons. He says that days before the peace deal was signed, instead of disarming, government forces and rebel groups were still stockpiling small arms in violation of a UN arms embargo.
We found relatively new Chinese ammunition, for instance, and we saw some Eastern European guns that were old but were definitely new to South Sudan. They were models that had never been documented in the country. So the question is, how do they get in?
In March, a UN panel of experts found similar arms embargo violations. The report noted secret shipments of military weapons into the country. But despite these violations, Brian Kastner says the arms embargo has made a difference.
The embargo doesn't fix every problem, but it has been able to reduce the level of the overall violence.
Fighting has driven millions of South Sudanese from their homes. They've fled to refugee camps in neighboring Uganda, Ethiopia, and Kenya, or they've sheltered in civilian protection camps in the country. But because of coronavirus, the borders are now closed. And earlier this month, one displacement camp in Juba recorded its first case of COVID-19. That means many in South Sudan are stuck. And some worry that the ongoing violence will make it harder to halt the spread of the coronavirus. On Tuesday, President Salva Kiir told the country that the pandemic is a threat to everyone.
The disease we are fighting does not differentiate between whether this is a Muslim or a Christian, a Dinka or a Choli, SPLM or IO or any other political party.
On Friday, the UN Security Council will vote on whether or not to renew its arms embargo in South Sudan and whether to keep sanctions and travel bans against individuals who have contributed to the conflict. For the world, I'm Halima Gikandi.
2-1-0 and liftoff, the final liftoff of Atlantis on the shoulders of the space shuttle.
It is hard to believe, but it's been nearly a decade since an astronaut was launched into space from American soil. Yesterday at Cape Canaveral, Florida, the company SpaceX and NASA tried to end that streak on board the Falcon 9, but 16 minutes before liftoff...
Dragon SpaceX, unfortunately, we are not going to launch today. You are go for 5.100 launch scrub.
Bad weather scrapped the mission. The mission was supposed to be the culmination of a decade-long partnership between NASA and a private company. Margaret Weidekamp is the head of the Space History Department at the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum in Washington. Thanks for being with us. So yesterday was postponed. Weather happens. What do you make, though, of this shift to privately owned spacecrafts?
It is a really exciting new way of ordering the relationship between NASA and private companies. Now, we know that the Apollo missions, those spacecraft were built by private companies. This is a new kind of relationship where NASA is not just asking for a private company to make it, but to actually fly it.
Are there problems with decentralizing it that way?
I think that what they are looking forward to is being able to have different companies approaching
the same kind of problem. And so the hope really is that by having SpaceX have its solution and Boeing have its solution, then you have an increased number of ways that you can support the International Space Station, which is still being supported by international partners.
So we heard the last launch of Atlantis a moment ago. And since 2011, U.S. astronauts have been hitching rides to space with Russia. Most agree it's been a pretty fruitful partnership between the two superpowers. So how do you see the shift to private American companies affecting the U.S.-Russian space collaboration?
Being able to add private companies providing not only cargo but crew service to the International Space Station removes at some level the over-reliance on the vagaries of geopolitics. And it also then, I think NASA is hoping, opens up their options in terms of turning their attention to exploration going back to the moon, perhaps onto Mars, and also then being able to put the focus on international collaborations in terms of planetary science and astronomy.
So finally, this historic flight, it's slated to happen in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic. What special precautions were taken to ensure the safety and health of the astronauts and crews? And do you think they should have delayed for a few months or even a year to lessen the odds that the virus would not end up on board the International Space Station?
I know that they have stepped up the crew isolation in anticipation of the launch, and additional precautions were taken about trying to make sure that there's no transmission of the virus to the International Space Station. I think the biggest loss is how many of us would have certainly made a trip to Florida to make sure that we were able to see this historic launch in person will instead be kind of collectively having the experience of watching it online or on television.
Margaret Weidekamp, the head of the Space History Department at the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum in Washington, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
The next launch attempt is scheduled for this Saturday at 3:22 p.m. Eastern. Until then, astronauts Bob Behnken and Doug Hurley remain in quarantine. Good luck, guys. That's where we leave you today, but we're always up there in orbit in the cloud at theworld.org. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.